Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, we will be tackling one of the most significant topics being discussed so far in all of 2025, namely crypto assets and the SEC's crypto task force. To help guide us through the conversation, we are very, very pleased to welcome back to the show none other than SEC Commissioner Hester Peirce. As the head of the task force, Commissioner Peirce shares her unique perspective regarding specific focus areas, collaboration with the industry, and other notable items from the first half of 2025. In our headline section, FinCEN recently announced that the compliance date for the AML rule for investment advisors is being delayed by 2 years. And finally, we'll wrap up today's show with another installment of History Has Your Back, where the story of a famous stockbroker and humanitarian demonstrates the importance of unsung heroes. Moving into our headlines section, on July 21st, 2025, FinCEN announced that the compliance date for the AML rule for investment advisors is being delayed by 2 years, and that FinCEN intends to revisit the AML rule through a rulemaking process, and finally, that FinCEN and the SEC would jointly reopen the customer identification rule. The new compliance date for the AML rule is January 1st, 2028, and this announcement follows intensive engagement by the Investment Advisor Association, as well as other industry groups, with both FinCEN and the SEC. In its press release, FinCEN stated, quote, "The IAAML rule seeks to address ongoing illicit finance risks, threats, and vulnerabilities posed by criminals and foreign adversaries that exploit the U.S. financial system and assets through investment advisors. FinCEN recognizes, however, that the rule must be effectively tailored to the diverse business models and risk profiles of the investment advisor sector. FinCEN also recognizes that extending the effective date of the rule may help ease potential compliance costs for industry and reduce regulatory uncertainty while FinCEN undertakes a broader review of the IAAML rule. While FinCEN will work through the rulemaking process to extend the effective date, FinCEN intends to provide the IA sector with regulatory certainty by issuing appropriate exemptive relief delaying the effective date. During the delayed effective date, FinCEN intends to revisit the substance of the IAAML rule through a future rulemaking process and, together with the SEC, also intends to revisit the joint proposed rule establishing customer identification program rule requirements for investment advisors," end quote. This news is obviously huge in the registered investment advisor space and will likely change many of the focus areas for compliance officers at their firms for the rest of 2025. And this show would like to thank all of those industry groups, including the Investment Advisor Association and others, as well as FinCEN and the SEC for their responsiveness to the advocacy that was put forward on behalf of the industry. As we move into the interview section of today's show, I am honored to bring back to the Compliance and Context podcast a favorite guest of ours and someone who we have featured many times in some of the other segments that we've done on the show. Please welcome back Commissioner Hester Peirce. Hester, thank you so much for taking the time to join the podcast today. We're going to be talking about a very exciting area here in the investment management industry, in the securities compliance industry, which is the SEC's crypto task force. And again, we are just so honored and thrilled to have you back on the show. So thank you very much for
Patrick, I'm delighted to be back. And I, as you know from before, I've got to start with my disclaimer, which is that my views are my own views as a commissioner, not necessarily those of the SEC or my fellow commissioners.
Of course. Absolutely. And thank you for that. And, you know, as we get started today, I thought it'd be, you know, important. We are, you know, listeners tend to run the gamut as far as experience levels. And but everybody is obviously very, very interested in compliance and in what's happening in the financial services and in the investment management industry. But I thought it might be helpful just to do a little bit of a level set here at the top and maybe talk a little bit about your role at the SEC, but more specifically, now with the SEC's crypto task force in kind of its establishment, within the commission, and what are some of its goals and some of its mission?
Sure. The task force was set up right after the inauguration by then acting chairman Mark Ueda. And the idea was that there had been an approach taken by the prior SEC that was really not very productive in this space. It really focused primarily on enforcement. And there was a lot of concern from people within the crypto world that the rules really weren't clear and the enforcement appeared a bit arbitrary, or quite arbitrary actually, and quite punitive for an area where people were saying, hey, help us to figure out how our what we're doing interacts with the securities laws. Instead, they were just met with enforcement actions. So the idea of setting up the task force was to say, let's do a reset here. Let's take a step back. Let's think about what are the big areas of confusion? What can we do to provide clarity with the authority that we already have? And where are areas where maybe there are regulatory gaps? And that's something that then, if Congress decides to fill those gaps, they can do that. And so we viewed our role then as being part of the process of just bringing a more rational, deliberate approach to the SEC, making sure that the public was involved in figuring out how to move forward in this space. And so that's really what the task force has been doing. It's a relatively small group of folks, but we work very closely with people across the commission. And, you know, we view our job as initially providing guidance where we can and working with the staff to do that. And then, of course, moving on to, in the longer run, rulemaking.
Yeah, that is incredibly helpful background. And thank you for that context. A small but mighty group inside the commission.
That's right.
You know, one of the things that I really appreciated your words earlier this year in February, when you talked about how the journey begins, and you outlined a few of the different items that the task force would be looking at there, you know, of some of the 10 items that you kind of specifically called out in that address. Are there any in particular that you've been kind of focused on to start, or that maybe just organically have received a little bit more attention? And are there some where you've in fact received a lot of feedback, from the industry?
Yeah, so we did put out the set of questions, and we've gotten a lot of feedback in response to that. And then we also had a set of five roundtables. So it was interesting to see, sort of the responses. People are putting in written responses, and we've really appreciated it. People have taken a lot of time. Some people are answering just a few of the questions. Some people are answering all of the questions. They're doing a series of letters to respond. And so we really appreciate the thought that people are putting into it. But with respect to the roundtables, I think one thing we saw is that there was a lot of interest in the tokenization roundtable. And so I think that is an area where I guess I'm not surprised to see the interest, but when we sort of flipped the switch and we said, we're going to do a new approach here, take a new approach here, a lot of people said, hey, we're interested in thinking about how this technology might be applicable in the traditional financial world. So that has been one area that we've gotten a lot of interest. I think, of course, the perennial questions about where's the line between securities and non-securities is one that people are always interested in weighing in on as well.
Yeah, I think certainly, and we've got as we get into kind of our conversation today, I'm sure we'll dovetail into some of those other items that have been of particular importance for the industry. And it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned this kind of in your initial kind of introduction to the crypto task force today, but I certainly think that the SEC's approach or stance and willingness, I think, to collaborate with the industry has been felt any number of different ways. And certainly that starts at the top, right, with the chairman, Paul Atkins, and his work, and obviously his, focus to really be, intentional in this area and not to shy away from it, but rather let's make sure that we can build the proper guardrails around it and put it in a place place where it can continue to help drive innovation. And so I know he had a keynote address at one of the crypto task force roundtables where he was talking about tokenization, but he was also identifying just generally, he identified three areas when it came to crypto asset policy. He talked about issuance, custody, and trading. And maybe I thought it might be nice for us. We can kind of talk a little bit about each one of those topics. And I'll read for you a couple quotes here. One from Chair Atkins, and actually one that you kind of articulated on the issuance area. From Chairman Atkins, he said, quote, "First, I intend for the commission to establish clear and sensible guidelines for distributions of crypto assets that are securities or subject to an investment contract. I have asked the commission staff to consider whether additional guidance, registration exemptions, and safe harbors are needed to create pathways for crypto asset issuances within the United States. I believe that the commission has broad discretion under the Securities Act to accommodate the crypto industry, and I intend to get it done." Love the last part of that quote, by the way. Later in your speech at the SEC Speaks, you indicated, quote, "Most crypto assets in existence today are not instruments enumerated in the definition of security," end quote. So my question for you is a little bit open-ended, but I would love your thoughts, which is, how do you see the area of issuance evolving over the next few years, and how can the SEC really establish itself as a leader in the space, both domestically and internationally?
Well, I'm glad that you highlighted Chairman Atkins' speech, because he has taken a position which has just been really refreshing for me to see, which is that this is work that we can do, it's work that we should be doing, and we're going to do this work, and really setting the tone for wanting to create a welcoming atmosphere for innovation, but also recognizing that there are areas where our existing regulatory framework touches upon crypto and we have to apply it. Now, we do also have a lot of authority from Congress already to use exemptions as necessary to provide relief from regulatory obligations when that makes sense to do that. And so I think with respect to issuance specifically, we do think that a rulemaking would be helpful. At least, it's certainly something that I think is a good idea. And so it's something that we're working with the staff on that. And I think it would be helpful to try to do that quickly. Now, rulemaking is time consuming, and it is that way for a reason. Not only do we need to do our homework here before we put out a proposal, but we also need to get input from people who are thinking about doing token issuances and people who perhaps are thinking of buying tokens and people who might think this whole endeavor is not a good idea. We want the full range of input. And so people will have an opportunity to weigh in, but we are hoping, at least I'm hoping, that we can move forward quickly.
Yeah, no, I think I would just, kind of underscore what you mentioned about Chairman Atkins and the broader approach. And I think that's such you used the word refreshing. And I will say that I think that is felt certainly in the industry, especially when it comes to the rulemaking process, right? I think being able to, for the regulators and the commission, the staff, to really have that kind of, connectivity and conversations that they're having with the industry and those that are living and breathing and seeing this stuff day in and day out and may have even dealt with or felt, where are the pain points, where are the advantages, or where can we win, and areas like that that I think are really, really helpful and ultimately make for hopefully much better rulemaking. So we certainly appreciate that. One of the other areas that Chairman Atkins mentioned was in the area of custody. And I think it would be really helpful, even just if it's a refresher for some of our folks out there that may be a bit more experienced or for some of our newer folks. But can you talk a little bit about, why this issue of custody can be so challenging in the crypto space?
Yeah, sure. And I think it's important to remember that custody can mean different things, or can, you know, it has different permutations, right? You've got broker-dealer custody, investment advisor custody, and investment company custody. The rules are different in each of those areas. So we do have to, you know, that's one of the reasons it's complicated, right? Because we've got to deal with issues in each one of those three areas. But I think part of what has happened here is because the prior approach from the SEC was, was that everything looked like a security to, not to me, but to others at the agency. There was a lot of concern that, you know, that meant that the custody rules had to apply to this stuff. And for crypto assets, there isn't necessarily a custodian out there. So then what do you do?
Right.
And in certain instances, you know, with crypto assets, you may need the ability as an advisor serving your client to be able to trade those assets on an exchange, for example. And so what does that mean for custody? There have been longstanding questions around qualified custody for investment advisors, not just related to crypto, but more generally, what does it mean to be a qualified custodian? So that overlay makes it more complicated. And then to further complicate matters, we did put out a safeguarding rule, which was a modernization of the SEC's existing investment advisor custody rule. And part of that modernization effort would have extended it to apply to crypto. And there was a lot of concern from a lot of people that it would have been very difficult to satisfy the proposed requirements there. So that safeguarding rule that's an approach that's kind of off the table. Perhaps modernization of the custody rule is needed, but we can, you know, take a fresh look at that. And then the questions around qualified custody are ones that we're actively interested in. But I think one of the things that has changed that does matter for this discussion is, as I've said, I don't think that most crypto assets are securities. Now, you can certainly design a crypto asset to be a security. You can do that. I've said this in the context of tokenizing traditional stock. You certainly can have a security there. But for things that aren't securities, the custody rules apply in a different way. And so that's something that is shifting a bit, and people have to sort of readjust their views of this whole topic given that shift. But in any event, I think it's good to take a step back and remember what we're trying to get at with the custody rules, which is really to ensure that if you are entrusting someone else with your crypto assets, that those assets are safe and that you know what happens if that party that's holding your crypto assets fails or it goes away or whatever happens, you want to have a sense of what is the status of your crypto assets. And so I think if we remember what the purpose of the custody rules is, it can help us to shape proper approaches.
Yeah, no, that is really, really helpful. And thank you again for even at the top of your response, framing the different ways that custody can really impact a lot of the different firms that are out there. For broker dealers, it's going to mean one thing. For investment advisors, it's going to mean another. And for investment companies, it's going to mean something else. And that above everything else is one of the reasons why it's complicated. But I certainly appreciate your additional comments there, and the idea that maybe we should be going back to basics sometimes about kind of the original premise for the custody rule and what it is that we're really trying to protect. And I kind of felt a little bit of that, or at least I sensed a little bit of that. You had a speech back in April of this year called Lava and Lamps. And you talked about how the overall regulatory approach should recognize the differences across crypto assets. Qualified custodians exist for some crypto assets, but for others, self-custody might be the safer option. Can you maybe provide just a little bit about, you know, what self-custody would entail and kind of a little bit about what you meant by that?
Well, yeah. And I should say that self-custody, that term can mean different things, right? I think for someone in the crypto world, when you say self-custody, the person means not your keys, not your coins, that you're holding your own crypto assets. What we're talking about here is if you have an investment advisor that's trying to help someone with crypto assets, does that advisor need to go to a third party custodian, or can that advisor hold those crypto assets itself? And there one reason may be that there isn't a third party that's out there that's able to provide custody. Mm-hmm. Another reason is that you may feel that it's you can do it better, or you can do it in a way that enables you to manage that asset in a way that's beneficial to your client. And so, you know, again, the goal is that you are taking care of that asset, making sure that nothing happens to it, right? So I don't think anyone should take on the job of custody lightly. And so I think we do have to be careful as we think about that, and not just, you know, assume that everything is going to be okay. But I think there are instances in which if there's no one else to do it, mm-hmm. you might actually be better off doing it yourself as an advisor.
Yeah, no, that certainly makes sense. And again, I think one of the things that you've continued to kind of articulate today that I think is critical is the having kind of more of an open mind when it comes to identifying what is going to be the best possible solution, while of course still maintaining a lot of the primary, you know, objectives when it comes to, you know, the SEC and what it's doing and how it regulates the industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a nice way of putting it, because the important point to remember is it is exciting. The new technology is exciting. These new kinds of assets are exciting. But we also have to remember that some of the problems that have emerged in traditional finance have emerged precisely because you have centralized intermediaries that are holding something on behalf of someone else or doing something on behalf of someone else. And if those entities have conflicts or if they have bad motives, really bad things can happen to their clients. And that doesn't change simply because you're doing it you're doing something in the crypto space. There's a benefit sometimes in that there's more transparency, but that's not always the case if things are happening off chain. And so I think we always need to remember that we always need to not forget the lessons of the past, even as we're thinking about whether this new technology maybe should give people more latitude to do different things. We have to keep in mind the risks that we're trying to protect people from.
Yeah, no, that a great context, I think, to add, and completely agree with that, and that's been consistent message from you that we've heard over the years, and now from, you know, Chairman Atkins and some of his speeches on it.
I guess one other point I'd like to make as I'm thinking about this is, you know, the technology is changing and best practices are changing over time. And so I also want to make sure that we're not doing something that I think is really a bad regulatory practice, which is to build into the rules a specific technical way of doing something. So then people are following your rule long after that is believed to be the best practice in the industry. So we need to make sure that whatever rules we adopt are able to, you know, be principles based so that they update as best practices update over time.
That's a great point, and one that I'm glad that you mentioned, because having a rule that might be really prescriptive and that would lock people into a certain way of doing things, again, starts to cut against some of the original benefits or other areas that we've talked about that are so unique and I think positive about this area with regard to innovation and stuff like that. But thank you.
And the way we kind of get backed into that prescriptive kind of rulemaking, and I see this outside of the crypto area all the time, is people will come in and say, well, yeah, we're doing things right, but we want to have a base level for the people who aren't doing things right. And so just codify the way we're doing things so that everyone else has to do what we're doing. And, you know, sometimes that is very well intentioned, but sometimes that's also just a sort of a way of building a regulatory barrier to entry into the law. So we need to be very careful about how we approach these things and thinking about what's driving people's requests to us as well.
Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you very much for sharing that and wonderful kind of background and context on one of the novel parts of that issue. In if we move to the other area that Chair Atkins mentioned, which was trading, in his May 12th speech, Chair Atkins said, "Nothing, quote, nothing in the federal securities laws prohibits registered broker dealers with an alternative trading system from facilitating trading in non-securities, including via, quote, pairs trading between securities and non-securities. I have asked the staff to help us devise ways to modernize the ATS regulatory regime to better accommodate crypto assets." So one question I had was, do you think the industry can expect maybe some broker dealers that might have a little bit more punch to maybe go to market or think about going to market with some kind of super application platform that offers trading in securities and non-securities and other financial services stuff kind of all under one roof?
Yeah, I mean, I think you certainly, as the chairman said, you certainly can do that under the existing rule set. Now, sometimes the SEC has put barriers in the way of people who have wanted to do that. But I think the statute doesn't say that that can't be done. And so it might very well make a lot of sense for the customers of an entity that we regulate, of a broker dealer. It might very well make sense for that broker dealer. And so we're happy to talk with broker dealers who are interested in doing that, with ATSs that want to do that. Of course, there are a lot of complexities and we get that, but we're willing to work with people through the regulatory complexities as they're thinking about, you know, does this make sense for them?
Yeah, that's great. And on a related trading note, this next question is very, very broad. So feel free to answer this however you best see fit. But when it comes to, and again, I think the industry is very excited about the shift in approach more broadly and the commitment. Is maybe the word that I'll use from Chairman Atkins, from yourself, from others, to think about being able to provide effective and additional guidance and rulemaking in the space. You know, just more broadly, do you think this is kind of a little bit of a toss up, but I am interested just because I do think it's important to talk about, you know, how do you see that additional guidance or rulemaking really being helpful for those that maybe are looking to the future and the listing and trading of crypto assets on some of the national securities exchanges?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of questions that have to be answered about that. But I think that we can work through some of those in guidance, FAQs, frequently asked questions, things like that, that can really be tailored to the specific challenges and pain points that people are running into, and they can come talk to us and we can figure that out. And I think rulemaking allows all of us just to kind of sit down and think about what makes sense in this area. I mean, that is an open-ended question. We're working on rules and guidance in a lot of different places and trying to figure out how to prioritize commission staff time and dealing with these issues as well. But I think one other thing to point out is that any moment like this is also a good opportunity for us to think whether the rules as they're written for our traditional regulated entities are working, or whether we need to make some changes. So I gave a speech not too long ago that sort of was, you know, thinking about the way we regulate exchanges. Does it allow them enough room for innovation? Are there constraints that we've put on them that make it very difficult for them to innovate? And so I think one of the exciting things about a time like this is that we can really think through those issues again and make sure that if a national securities exchange wants to be able to do some of these things, that we can have that conversation with them as well about what would that look like. I don't know if that really answers your question.
No, it does. It definitely does. And I appreciate some of that additional thoughts. I think it sets up and I am certainly excited that, you know, at the time, Acting Commissioner Ueda, you know, helped establish the Crypto Task Force. I am thrilled that you are leading you know, the efforts from the agency. I appreciate, you know, you mentioned it before, but I will just highlight for the benefit of some of our listeners, all of the work that has already been done, right? I mean, we talked about, you talked about in your remarks at the SEC Speaks conference, you've received more than 100 written submissions. And this is, again, you know, a couple months ago, so I'm sure that's only gone up.
Numbers higher.
Yeah, 100 written you know, submissions, held over 100 meetings with industry participants and other members of the public. You know, you've continued to issue new crypto guidance during that time, including stuff on crypto mining, on, you know, broker-dealer custody of crypto assets, and obviously the continued support from the staff and the commission in these areas. And so it is so appreciated. And I will also mention some of the direct participate, you know, some of the other activities like proof of stake and delegated proof of stake systems, you know, all of these different things. I think the industry welcomes that feedback from the commission. So thank you to you and the staff for taking up the mantle, so to speak. And I know certainly that it's work that you're passionate about.
Well, and thank you to people in the industry who and in the broader public who have taken the time to respond. I mean, we don't take that for granted. We know that a lot of work has gone into those responses and into participation in our roundtables and thinking about these issues. So we're grateful.
Yeah. Well, thank you for such an incredible discussion on such an important and robust topic. We like to say here on the Compliance and Context podcast, though, that no good deed goes unpunished. And so while I'm done asking you technical questions about crypto assets, I have one question. We like to ask another more fun question for a lot of our guests. So my question for you today is, and some of our listeners, I was an English major. I am certainly a word nerd, and now in my profession, more of a securities nerd. And I have to give you a little bit of street cred here, because there are very few people out there that I think are a finer, funnier, better, more entertaining read than you are when it comes to combining, I think, legal and compliance topics in the investment management, in the securities compliance industry. So thank you for all of your authorship in that space and for really taking the time, I think, to make those speeches and statements meaningful. But one question for you would be, maybe what's one book that you've really enjoyed reading over the last year? And that's, you know, regardless of whether it's securities related or not. And then if I could maybe bolt on one tiny question, you know, what's part of that inspiration behind why you really enjoy writing or sharing some of that creativity in your authorship?
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. I do have to give credit to the great people who work with me on those speeches. So I certainly cannot take all that credit myself. I do love to read books. I've always really enjoyed biographies. And so I like to read biographies from a wide range of people, whether that's people who have been in the financial industry or any other biographies, really. I find them fascinating. So I just a few months ago read the biography of Sidney McLaughlin Lavrone, who is an Olympian, a hurdler, and I enjoyed her story. It's just really interesting to hear how someone rises to that level. I'm reading a book now about a woman who was biking with the butterflies. Also a very interesting story of someone who's done something that I could never do. So I enjoyed that as well. In terms of my inspiration of why I like to put some time into writing, I think that writing helps me to think about issues. And I hope that my writing can also help other people to think about issues and about, you know, maybe pointing out where I'm wrong about things, because it does help people to see my thought process. And so I, you know, kind of put it out there with the hope that people will come back and say, Hester, you've got this completely wrong. Let's figure out a better way forward.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I will say one of the things that I appreciate or really like most about a lot of your speeches and statements are the analogies that you draw and how that then relates to real life? Because I think that makes some really complicated securities law and compliance concepts a little bit more relatable for folks, right? When you're talking about that and they can remember when they were a kid in a car ride heading up to Maine for the summer and what that road trip would look like and what kind of challenges and other things you might face along the way. I just think that helps make it more real for folks. And so, you know, thank you for all that you do. Thank you for your service at the commission. Thank you for leading the crypto task force. And of course, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Well, Patrick, thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it. I hope you have a good rest of the summer and a little cooler there in Ohio.
Thank you very much. Take care. Thank you.
Take care.
The final part of today's show features another segment of History Has Your Back. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, this segment represents the part of the podcast where we go back in time to help us better understand the present, help define where we're headed in the future, and demonstrate how the lessons of the past can be applied to our compliance programs today. In 1939, as Europe braced for the horrors of war, a quiet hero emerged, not from the ranks of soldiers or statesmen, but from the office of a London stockbroker. Nicholas Winton, a young British banker on vacation, found himself in Prague, where Jewish families were already facing persecution. Moved by their desperation, Nicholas gave up his comfortable life and set out to do the unthinkable: rescue as many children as he could before the Nazis closed the border. Winton organized what would become known as the Czech Kinder Transport. He forged documents, navigated endless bureaucratic red tape, and begged strangers for donations in foster homes in Britain. He arranged 8 trains to carry nearly 670 children to safety, children who would have otherwise likely been swallowed up by the Holocaust. He did all of this quietly, without recognition, driven by his sense of moral duty. For 50 years, Nicholas told no one about this, not even his wife. His heroic deeds might have remained a secret forever had she not discovered an old scrapbook in the attic filled with names and photos and letters from the rescued children. Decades later, on a BBC program, Winton was invited as a guest, unaware that the studio audience was filled with those very children, now adults and many with families of their own. They stood and applauded the man who had given them life. There are so many different things to like about that story, but two stand out to me for our purposes today. Number one, there is good in the world and it's worth fighting for. And number two, just because some of the good things you do might go unnoticed, that doesn't take away from the positive impact that those actions can make. For any of those compliance officers that might feel like they are often an unsung hero whose work and effort goes unnoticed, take solace in knowing that you are still making an incredible and positive difference inside your firm, even if there's no one there to celebrate it. And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, CALFI and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guest, Commissioner Hester Peirce, for coming on the show today and sharing her fantastic insights on the SEC's Crypto Task Force. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast, or on X using the handle @CompliancePod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.